You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 14th to the 20th of January 2016. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by Acting Features Editor Paul Jump, Rankings Reporter Ellie Bothwell and Deputy News Editor John Morgan. Which universities are the most international in the world? And more to the point, why does it matter? Today, we publish our list of the top 200 institutions for Global Outlook. It's good news for the UK, not so good for the US, and a surprise at the very top of the table. More on that from Ellie shortly. UK universities have a legal duty to stop students being radicalised, but how compatible are the prevent requirements with the concept of free speech and academic freedom? It's been a much debated issue in the last week. Our cover feature looks at it today. We asked a group of experts to share their views on the Academy's role in counter-terrorism. Paul will fill us in shortly. And John has been speaking with Ed Balls, Gordon Brown's former right-hand man, who is now a visiting professor at King's College London. It's our second feature this week, and he'll have some of the top lines from that discussion in just a moment. But first, internationalisation. Ellie, this week we publish the top 200 universities based on their international outlook. Why have we done this and what did we find out?
So we did this partly just to kind of shed light on an area that we include in the main World University Rankings. International Outlook is one of the five sort of main pillars. And so we just decided to kind of delve in deeper to the figures and see which would come out top if we just ranked them on their international outlook, and that is the proportion of international students, proportion of international staff, and the proportion of research papers published with at least one author outside the country. Mm. And it threw up some quite interesting results. Qatar University tops the list, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, perhaps that's a good time just to run down the top five. Obviously, you'll find the top 200 on timeshighereducation.com, but at five, the University of Geneva, four, École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne in Switzerland, three is the University of Hong Kong, two, University of Luxembourg, and sorry to interrupt you, as you were saying, number one is Qatar University.
Yeah, so I mean, it's an institution that wouldn't kind of make the upper echelons of our main ranking. It probably doesn't, publish the number of research papers that, say, Harvard and Oxford are going to. But on a kind of international front, it is top. I mean, part of that is its sort of location, and it does admit that. But it does also sort of, the Vice Chancellor told us that part of it is to do with a national research fund that the state has introduced. So it isn't just a ranking of internationalisation based on geography. There is sort of more to it than that as well. Another interesting finding is that North America isn't really represented very well in this list at all. I think the first Canadian institution is at number 40, mm-hmm. The first US is at number 90.
That's MIT.
Yeah. So that's sort of quite different from what you'd find in our main rankings.
You might expect it though, mightn't you? I mean, co-authorship is one of the indicators. I guess you could argue that an academic based in Alaska doing research with an academic in Hawaii and one in Michigan, is doing some pretty interesting work with some fairly diverse institutions, and perhaps there's more of an inclination in the US to work with other US institutions, and they'd be punished for that. Whereas if someone in Germany did some work with an institution over the border in Switzerland, they would be, that would be considered an international collaboration. So I suppose that methodology maybe penalises North America slightly.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, obviously, Luxembourg. University of Luxembourg is number two, and Switzerland does really well. And these are small countries that are sort of in the middle of Europe, mm-hmm. with a lot of other neighbours they can work with. I mean, another thing to do with the US is that although a lot of international students go to the US, they have sort of more students overall. So there's a sort of feeling that their proportion maybe isn't as high as you would get in, say, the UK. There is good news for the UK here. It's the sort of most represented nation by far, and London is kind of one of the top areas. I think if London was sort of counted as a country, it would be the third most represented.
Mm. Now that sort of maybe quashes some of those concerns that I raised, because UK is an island nation. It certainly has the huge sort of universities of similar size that you might find in the US, and yet they are managing to bring in this sort of international flavour, managing to perhaps do more collaborative work. And maybe, you know, there's a very honest ranking. I mean, those are the indicators that we're using, and perhaps it's good that we do look at that and give some credit to perhaps some of the more unsung institutions that don't have their praises sung perhaps quite so loudly in the overall rankings, which are very US dominated.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think also, you know, we're sort of aware that these are just sort of three indicators, as you say, and if we were kind of going to do a more sort of well-rounded ranking in the future, looking at internationalisation, there might be sort of plenty of other measures we could include. So, you know, it'd be interesting to hear what other things people think that we could be including in this.
Indeed, yeah, and you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. You can comment at timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Facebook and on LinkedIn. And we, as ever, welcome your thoughts on all the content that we publish there. Moving on, our cover feature this week looks at the Prevent guidance, which sort of speaks to UK universities and their legal duty to stop students from being radicalised. It's a hot topic at the moment, Paul, and you've been asking some experts within universities to share their views on the Academy's role in counter-terrorism.
Yeah, I have indeed. Yeah, of course. Yeah, last week many people will have seen the Daily Mail's big supposed exposés of universities permitting Islamists to indoctrinate, as the Mail would have it, the students on campus. But, you know, it's topical anyway, of course, because although Prevent's been around for a number of years, it became a statutory duty last year. And I think by 22nd of January, English universities have got to tell Hefke how they're planning to comply with the law. So it's very much, you know, at the top of everybody's agenda anyway. So we basically asked around to see what people made of it. You know, not surprisingly, perhaps most people are not particularly enamoured with it. You know, particularly the idea that academics will be are supposed to monitor students for signs of radicalisation. You know, a lot of people make the point that even the security services struggle to do that, so how academics are supposed to do it. And the idea that this also might sort of poison the relationship between students and researchers.
Mm.
There's the other aspect of Prevent is, you know, who you permit to speak on campus, which obviously also plays into a wider debate about freedom of speech that's been very prominent recently. I think that the Prevent law requires universities, if they have a sort of speaker that's potentially, you know, going to inspire extremism, then I think they're obliged to have somebody on the same platform to speak against that. So again, there's some doubt about how workable that is and whether that will end up catching all kinds of other topics that really aren't a threat to anybody. One of the people that contributes to the article suggests that this could prevent somebody talking about Plato's Republic as well, because obviously Plato's no fan of democracy, and potentially you could fall foul of rules that prohibit people speaking against sort of British values.
Yeah, but
quite broadly.
There's a common sense test at play, though, isn't there? I mean, I think in that case, is it not just someone being deliberately confrontational to this legislation and looking for holes? I mean, I think we all know a debate about Plato would be welcome in universities and probably wouldn't be attracting the eye of the police.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I think that is an extreme example, but there are clearly it illustrates the point that there is a lot of grey area there. Ultimately, it comes down to the police to interpret what counts as extremism, and you know, who knows what particular cases, you know, may end up being deemed extremism that some people would think fell the other side of the line. I mean, it's also worth saying though that there are not everybody's against that Prevent. I mean, there are some sort of people speaking from a secular point of view in the article that make the point that, you know, universities are very hard on preventing right-wing extremists from speaking on campus, and they don't extend, you know, the same sort of draconian approach to, you know, the sort of Islamist end of the spectrum. They think they should because the Islamists are indeed a threat. So there's certainly a range of views.
Mm. Now, it's a very interesting read. You'll find it in the magazine on page 36. This week, also of course on timeshighereducation.com, click the features tab at the top of the page there. Back in the UK, John, you met with Ed Balls, former schools secretary of course, also former shadow, also former shadow chancellor, and Gordon Brown's former right-hand man too. You never held a post that directly spoke to the university sector. What did you talk to him about?
Well, he's not a stranger to academia, for one thing. After PPE, Oxford, compulsory for politicians in this country. He studied at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard, and also taught at Harvard as a fellow in the economics department before going into politics. And in addition to his role as a visiting professor at the King's Policy Institute, he's also got a Harvard fellowship. So one of the things we talked about is his belief that politics can be taught, and his belief that we should have academic institutes that are where people are talking and learning about policy making. And his, the way he was talking about the King's Policy Institute, clear that he thinks that it, we should have something like the Harvard's Kennedy School in the UK. And another thing I talked about in terms of his, what he'll be doing at King's, is he has been co-teaching a master's module titled The Treasury and Economic History since 1945. So
he's hands-on.
Yeah, he's in the classrooms. And I asked him, if he's, he has indeed been teaching about his own time at the Treasury, which ran from 1997 to 2004. So I asked him, what will he teach students? Were the main policy successes and failures from that period? And he picked out some interesting things, saying that he thought it was a register of Labour's success that George Osborne runs the Treasury in very much the tradition that he and Gordon Brown established, as he sees it. The Treasury isn't just about sort of the narrow issues about financial stability; it's about growth and poverty, and about apprenticeships and issues like that. And he thinks that Labour's Treasury established a consensus around using the minimum wage and tax credits to combat inequality. And he says that Osborne has had to register that consensus in the fact that he wasn't able to cut tax credits. He was forced to back down on that. That's a register of Labour's success, he says, building consensus on those issues. And also picked out kind of the NHS, saying that there was initially, 1997, there was debate about whether it could survive as a taxpayer-funded universal service. Thinks the argument was won there. A failure, notable failure that he picked out in term for a higher education audience, is the fact that he called Labour's failure to find a sustainable way forward on HE funding, call that blot on Labour's copybook. He's very much an advocate of a graduate tax. He's critical of Labour on tuition fees.
An interesting read. You'll find that on page 40 in this week's magazine, and of course on the website. We mentioned the top 200 most international universities earlier. In addition to the full table, which you'll find on our site, and the news story we discussed today, we are publishing a number of student blogs, which you'll find on the student section of our website. Just click the student tab at timeshighereducation.com. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine, you can do so on Twitter at Times Higher Ed, via our website, or you'll also find us on LinkedIn and Facebook too. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.